Good afternoon. So, last time we talked a bit about deadlock. So, you mentioned sort of what the problem with deadlock was. We had these kind of resources that we were reserving, and while we had a resource reserve, we also tried to get more resources. And with something like locks, our process for doing that is we wait for the resource to be available, and that means, well, we don't have good bounds when we stop waiting. In particular, we can have this scenario where we have this circular dependency, where we're waiting for resources some other thread has, the other thread is somehow waiting on us too, possibly directly or possibly indirectly, but we have some sort of circular dependency. And we wanted some way of avoiding this. And kind of our chief strategy for avoiding this was having a consistent order in acquiring resources. And this avoids our circular dependency. And the reason why is if we think of kind of drawing arrows in the direction of our dependency, well, we have a consistent order, all the arrows have to go in one direction from A to B for any resource. And this means we can't actually get a loop. If we don't have a consistent order, that's when we have an opportunity to have those cycles, those loops that create this problem. And with something like locks, this is kind of the most common strategy. And you kind of enforce it by saying, OK, if I'm acquiring locking A and B, I'm always, always, always going to lock A before B. And usually this is doable. There's some cases where it's maybe not so easy because of the structure of your code. We saw with the linked list example that if our notion is, oh, we lock a linked list node, and then we lock the previous node, and then the next node, you know, we can't really make that consistent very easily if we have to like lock the node to find out what's the lock next. That's not going to be very practical. We might want some other strategy. And we saw some other strategies for avoiding deadlock. And a lot of these are attacking one property we need for deadlock, which is that we have to be holding a resource and waiting for another. And sort of one way of attacking that is if we only have one thing to lock, well, then there's no way we can hold that and wait for another resource because we're getting all the locks together. Or what you saw in the lab is if we, you know, only have one thread waiting for resources, getting the resources at a time, then you can't be holding resources and waiting for others because that other thread, you know, because only one thread can be getting resources at a time. And you know, we either get both of the locks or none of them. We don't have a chance for us to get one of the locks and another thread to get one of them, and we're waiting for the other. That was the first strategy in the lab. And other approaches are to do something that doesn't work like locks or change how lock works. So we can like abort and retry. If we have the option to do that, we can avoid deadlock because we're no longer waiting. Or if we have a way of sort of instead of waiting for someone to give up a resource, forcing them to give it up, that also avoids the problem. So let me talk a bit about deadlock detection. And the idea here is that if we can get the info on who's waiting for what and who has what, we can kind of draw that picture and work out if there's loops. And for things like locks, that's all we need to do. We just need to draw that picture, find out if there's a cycle. If you've taken the appropriate DSA class, you'll learn about cycle detection and graph, and you can apply that algorithm. This doesn't work so well when we have divisible resources. So like if we're doing the idea of I'm going to allocate some memory or wait for it to be available, this doesn't work so well because, well, you can have two things waiting for memory and that doesn't necessarily mean there's a cycle even if our picture has a cycle, depending on how much they're waiting for. So the strategy to kind of do this in the more general case is that we get that list of who's waiting for what and we look for any thread where we could give them right now everything they're waiting for. And if so, we say, okay, that thread, from what I can see right now, can finish. So we'll just remove that thread and everything it's holding, and then we'll repeat this process. And either we'll get to a point where we remove all the threads, in that case, there's no deadlock yet. Maybe there will be in the future when threads are waiting for more things, but not right now. And if we can't remove all the threads, we found a deadlock. And usually, you probably won't do this, but some systems that want to do things in response to deadlock that aren't so simple, like some databases, you know, we'll use this strategy to find whether when a deadlock happens and resolve it by, for example, making one of the things involved in the deadlock abort and retry later. So questions on deadlock topics. Okay, so then we started talking about monitors, which is where we're going to continue on today. And to introduce monitors, we talked about this producer-consumer problem, that we had a shared queue, which had one or more producers that would enqueue things on that queue, and one or more consumers that would dequeue things on the queue. And we wanted to have this idea that consumers would wait for the queue to have stuff on it when they were dequeuing, so they wouldn't just like try to dequeue something, find out there's nothing there, try again. That would waste a lot of CPU time. We want them to wait in some nice way for stuff to be available. And I don't have it written here, but if our queue has a limited size, if producers are trying to add stuff and there's not room, we want them to wait instead of just try to add something, doesn't work, try to add something, try again. No, we want them to wait if there's some bottleneck there. And we looked at sort of one solution for handling this. How do we do this wait if full operation? So how do we do that? And we need some way of having threads wait and letting them stop wait. And sort of our first mechanism for this was something called condition variables. And as I said, condition variables are horribly misnamed because you think they have a condition in them, they don't. They are a list of waiting threads. They provide operations to manipulate that list. So one operation they provide is this wait operation. So that's how you add yourself, you're calling wait, to that list of waiting threads. And this wait operation takes a lock as well as the condition variable. And the idea is it unlocks the lock as you start waiting. And why do we want to do this? Well, we don't want it to be the case that the thing we're waiting for happens after we decide to start waiting and before we start waiting. Because then we're just going to be waiting forever. So having this lock be unlocked at the same time is going to avoid that problem. That, for example, if we find out the queue is empty, this makes sure that the queue doesn't become full until we start waiting, because in order to put something on the queue, someone has to get the lock first. And they don't have a chance yet until we start waiting. Yes?
Why do the consumers need to wait?
Question, why do the consumers need to wait? So the consumers are trying to dequeue, and that's not going to work if the queue doesn't have something on it yet. Oh, sorry, consumers wait if queue full. That is because I made a typo on the slide. You are correct. Sorry. If queue is empty, so I need to correct this. And the producers wait if the queue is full. Thank you for pointing that out. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Is it possible to have multiple producers into one queue?
Question, is it possible to have multiple producers into one queue? Yes. And the idea is that, you know, we're going to use something like locks to make sure that when they enqueue at the same time, that they don't actually enqueue at the same time, that we somehow coordinate that so the queue doesn't get corrupted in some way, or we don't like try to overwrite the same like array element in a queue data structure, causing us to forget a value.
So is this the buffer or queue? Is that considered the shared resource?
Question, is the buffer or queue considered the shared resource? So for the purpose of our monitors, yeah. That would be our shared resource when we're using monitors to implement this. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about waiting. So we have this wait operation where we give up a lock at the same time as adding ourselves to the list. And that lock is going to ensure that when we start waiting, nothing's changed yet. And then when something changes, the thread making that change is going to figure out, oh, did some thread get ready to run based on what I just did? So if we're a producer, if we add something to the queue, then it's possible that some thread could take a value off the queue that was waiting. So what we'll do in that case is we'll use this signal function here, which is going to take the first thread on the queue, or one of the threads on the queue, I should say. We don't specify which one, but one of them, and let it run. And why would we choose this one? Well, if we're enqueuing one value, that's only going to want one thread successfully dequeue. So we're going to take one of the threads, let it run, and, you know, assuming that that thread is the one that tries to dequeue first, it's actually going to be able to dequeue. We learned last time that that doesn't always happen, that we had this scenario where it would try to dequeue, but by the time it got to run, some other thread ran in between and consumed a value before it got to, which is why we had to kind of double check all our locks, our conditions when we were waiting. We have this last operation, which is broadcast. This takes all the threads that are waiting and stops them from waiting. And this makes sense, like if we want to have a bunch of threads wait for, you know, if we want to have all the threads ready to go. So we saw an early example of waiting for like a finish flag to be true. If all the threads that are waiting for that flag to be true, well, they can all go. We should use broadcast to let them all go. And monitors, we saw, are built by combining a lock, some shared data that is going to change in some way, and these condition variables that we use to let threads wait until something is true about that shared data. Some questions? Yes. So the question is, when signal is called, is a thread from the head of the condition variable queue popped off? Yes, but the order of that queue is not specified. So when you wait, you're not necessarily added to the beginning or the end of the queue.
So is it just arbitrary?
Question, is it just arbitrary? Yes. So some systems will define the order more precisely, but in general, like it's usually just arbitrary. It probably would be nicer if the threads that have been waiting longer got to go first. And some systems, you might have notions that some threads you've marked as more important, maybe they should go first. But so there's order systems might have, but there's nothing specified by the condition variable itself. Does that answer your question? So the question is, when broadcast stops all the threads from waiting, wouldn't that cause synchronization issues? So the first thing the threads are going to do when they stop waiting is try to get the lock. So all threads will try to get the lock again. All threads first try to get lock. So what's going to happen is each of the threads are going to run one at a time after the broadcast happens, and only one at a time because they have to get the lock, and they can only get the lock one at a time. Does that answer the question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused. If broadcast stops all threads from waiting, but they still have to like sort of line up one at a time to get the lock. When you say you're stopping threads from waiting, does that just mean unpausing them from like trying to get the lock?
So the question is, when I say I stopped all threads from waiting, I'm unpausing them from trying to get the lock. What I'd say is that previously, I would say waiting on the CV, on the condition variable. CV. So neither of these let the threads run right away because they have to get the lock, and they probably can't get that right away. But they all make the threads not be paused on the condition variable, where they'd be paused indefinitely if we didn't do anything. So they're going to get to run and use the lock, which presumably, unless we have something like a deadlock or some similar bug, the lock is going to be available sometime shortly. That answer your question?
Yeah, so after you issue broadcast, they're not like, it's just like, they're not waiting on the lock. They're just like, there might be some time.
So the question is, there might be some time between when broadcast happens and they get the lock. So usually the way we use broadcast or signal, they're not going to be able to get the lock right away because we probably have it locked. So inevitably there will be some delay. With broadcast, they're not going to have to wait for us to release the lock, and probably if they're not the first thread in the that was released from waiting, they'll probably have to wait for some other threads to get the lock first. Yes? So the question is, why would we not do all the work in one thread? So the kind of things we're implementing here, do I have the example from last time? So it depends what we're implementing, whether that would make sense. So I guess examples we had before. So we had one example, which was wait for finished, right? This was an example we had last time. I don't have it in these slides right now. And we did we acquired a lock, and we did while finished isn't true, wait, we did a condition variable wait on some condition variable and some lock. And this lock. And then we returned. So in this case, it seems kind of an annoyance that each thread that's waiting for finish to be true is going to have to check the flag again and acquire the lock to do that. So it seems kind of inefficient in this case. And maybe it would be nice if we could come up with some way of letting them share the lock for just reading it. And there are locks of that type. So there's something called reader-writer locks where you have separate locks for reading that can be multiple people can acquire the read lock, but only one thread can acquire the write lock, which I was originally going to cover and was going to skip for time. Unfortunately, those don't work with at least POSIX condition variables, so that's not an option. Now, we have some other cases, like our producer-consumer example here, where what we're going to do after we stop waiting. Well, I guess this one doesn't make sense, but we might have other cases where, you know, maybe instead of just waiting for something to be true, we're going to, our code is going to be, you know, while something, wait, and then we're going to, you know, do something after that. And in that case, that something we're doing, we probably need to take turns to do that anyways. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So reader-writer locks don't work with POSIX condition variables. Are they used at all in POSIX systems?
Question, if POSIX reader-writer locks don't work with POSIX condition variables, are they used at all? Absolutely. And I note that one reason I didn't think it was a horrible thing not to go over those reader-writer locks is that you can implement them yourself, a version of them yourself, using mutexes and condition variables. That's kind of a classic exercise, in fact. Other questions? Okay, so talk briefly about anonymous feedback. So one thing about TAs spending lots of time with students, I try to tell TAs how not to do this, but my TAs really don't like feeling like a student's going to complain, they didn't help me. I need to have them fight this when they're spending over 30 minutes and find ways of having a student do something while you help another student so you don't have people waiting for a while. I'd also note that as much as I'd like RTAs to be nice and available, if it's an hour before the assignment due, we don't have the course staff to make that reliably available. That's just how demand for office hours happens. And my TAs aren't all available at a specific time anyways. Something saying, hey, I'm very glad that you made the labs better. Thank you for the compliment, but it wasn't on purpose. I just took the labs from the pilot, basically, with some exceptions. And apparently it happens that they have an uneven perceived difficulty, which I will think about how I'm fixing in future semesters. So for example, the pthreads lab this week is probably too short. So I think I need to think of a way of making the last extra approach something that could give enough skeleton code for, so you could do it in the time, add that. But yeah, this is not on purpose, even though, yes, I know it's working out better. Just happens to work out. And some complimentary feedback. So let's go back to our example here. So we had our, let's go to a different example here. So last time we were finishing up by looking at this example of our consumer waiting. So we have our producer consumer problem. In this case, our buffer is as big as we want it to be, so the producers never wait, they just always enqueue stuff. But the consumers need to wait until the buffer is empty. And we mentioned, because when we call signal here, it doesn't always wake up, it doesn't always mean the next thread to get the lock is going to be the one that we signaled, that we caused to not be waiting anymore. This means that we really do need this loop, even if we didn't have to worry about spurious wake-ups. We can have this scenario. And this was because, unfortunately, even though kind of one of the early proposals for these monitors was that the lock would kind of be handed off, this is not a feature that most threading libraries have actually implemented. Probably because they really care about making the locks really fast, and it's hard to do this and also make the locks really fast. Question. Is this C++ syntax? This is, yes, C++ syntax / pseudo Java syntax, if that helps. I assume because it's close enough to Java syntax that it wouldn't be confusing. But maybe I'm wrong. So, let's extend this to having a bounded buffer where both the producers and the consumers need to wait. So to do this, sort of the pattern I'm going to use is that, for everything we need to wait for, we're going to have a condition variable to represent the list of threads waiting for that. So we have one condition variable for threads that are waiting for there to be stuff in the buffer, and we're going to add a new one for them to be waiting for there to be space to put stuff in the buffer. So if the buffer, there's space ready in the buffer. And our producers, while the buffer's full, are gonna keep waiting for more space to be available. And our consume, we're gonna now signal that, hey, now there's one extra piece of space left, so we can run one more producer that was waiting. Question.
Also, is the reason why you wouldn't do broadcast because if there's multiple producers threads, they would all kind of enqueue?
So the question is, what is the reason I'm not doing broadcast? So if I did broadcast, it would be functional, but it would be slow. And the reason why it would be slow is that we wake up a bunch of producer threads, and let's think about how that works. The first one that wakes up, we made it one space on the buffer, assuming the buffer is a fixed size. And they're going to find out, I can enqueue one more item now, and that's going to work. But the second one, presumably the buffer will be full again. I'm assuming this buffer has like a fixed size of like n. And it won't get to do anything, even though we woke it up. So it will just be waking up. It will acquire the lock, be here. It will go back and check, is the buffer full? And the first one will find out it's not, add something to the buffer. The second one will find out, now the buffer's full again. So there's no reason to use broadcast. But if we did it, it wouldn't be wrong in the sense of it would behave correctly. And maybe we need to do broadcast if when we enqueued something that used a variable amount of slots in the buffer or something like that. That answer your question? Yeah.
So just to be clear, you're using signal because it only wakes up one producer thread at a time. So only one producer thread will try to enqueue something at a
question, I'm using signal because it only makes up one reducer thread at a time? Yes. And I know in this case that each time we call consume, my assumption is that that lets at most one producer thread go that couldn't go before. So if I didn't know that, I would need to call broadcast or do something more complicated. So another thing you might observe we could do is we could be really sloppy and just have one condition variable. We could just have a list of threads that are waiting. And in that case, well, we wouldn't be able to use signal anymore because signal might wake up a thread that's waiting for the buffer to be empty when the buffer's full or vice versa. So we'd have to use broadcast. So that would be correct. It would be slow because we'd be waking up threads, having them check, is the buffer okay for you now? And finding out, you know, half of them would probably find out no. But we could absolutely do that. We'd still be correct, still would work. Just be slow. Like, kind of using separate condition variables is optimizing to make sure we don't wake up threads that we don't need to be woken up. But we could just wake up the additional threads and have them figure out, oh, well, I didn't really need to wake up. Because, oh, the buffer's not really empty, or not really not empty anymore. Or maybe it was never really not empty, but that's fine. Questions? Yes. And kind of the general pattern when we're using monitors is that we're doing something with shared data, and often we'll have to wait for something to be true before we go on. So in our examples, it was like waiting for there to be something for us to dequeue, or waiting for the finish flag to be true. And then after that, we verify that condition's true, we're going to go on and manipulate data. If the condition's not true right away, we'll add ourselves to the wait list for one of our condition variables. And then wait and keep checking if the condition becomes true in time for us to actually manipulate the shared data. And note that we're checking such that in between when we check and when we manipulate the data, you know, we have the lock. Sort of have the lock this whole time. We do give up the lock while waiting, but the first thing we do after we get the lock back is check our condition again and then do the thing. So for example, when dequeuing, we know the buffer really wasn't empty by the time we got to that dequeue. You know, there's nothing snuck in and made the buffer empty. It's not possible. So then we manipulate the data, and then we check, okay, let's look at all the things other threads might be waiting for. Did I change them? If the answer is yes, go through each of the things I might have changed and broadcast for each of them I might have changed. And if we can think very carefully and know, oh, at most one thread would ever care about this, maybe we can signal instead. But if you're not sure, broadcast. Because the worst broadcast might be slower, but at least you're not going to miss a thread. Yes?
So would there, like on the slide, are you emitting another lock? It's like while not condition B.
Question, on the slide I'm emitting another lock while not condition B? So my assumption is there's some other function that's going to check condition B and do some different manipulation of the shared data. So I just need to know about all the things that all the condition variables that relate to my shared data and check all of them. You know, check your each of the list of threads that are waiting, have I changed what they're waiting for? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
How do you decide what a thread cares or doesn't care about when you choose between all the tasks and
signal? Question, how do I decide when a thread cares or doesn't care about? So the reasoning should be that if you broadcast, then at most one thread would be able to do anything no matter what. And this can be a bit subtle. I don't think I have the example here. Oh, do I? I have the example. I do have this example. So this can be a bit subtle. So one reason this can be subtle here is I have an example here where let's say, I should do this correctly. We signal onto data ready only if there's exactly one item. So this might seem like it works, but it doesn't, because our notion that at most one thread needs to go because of this doesn't quite work out. We haven't actually checked, did I do something that lets a thread waiting stop waiting? And the reason why is that we can have two produces happen before a consume happens. Right, and that means just because the size is not equal to one doesn't mean I didn't let a thread go that couldn't go before. So that's a case where this can be really subtle, and that's why I recommend if you aren't really sure, use broadcast. So what I did in the example I had here that kind of avoided that is it's pretty trivial to know that when I produce a value, that nets at most one thread go. And so I know that if someone's waiting, I'll wake up exactly one waiting thread if a thread started waiting per time I call produce. And if a thread doesn't start waiting, well, they're going to dequeue something anyway, so they're going to make progress. So that's how I can know that this is okay. But yes, it can be pretty subtle whether it's not as okay, because you have to think about, oh, when can produce and consume happen, or whatever other functions you have for your monitor to think about, is signal really okay? Does that answer your question? So question, broadcast is like a safer option? Yes. So you should think of like you signal like really makes sense in a lot of cases, especially the producer consumer pattern, but broadcast sort of, you know, is never going to have these sort of subtle issues of like, oops, you forgot to wake up a thread, despite the condition being true that the thread was waiting for. Other questions? Okay. So sort of our pattern for monitors is we have some shared data. We want to never touch the shared data without using lock. Remember the way locks work. They don't enforce that you use them. That's your job. You have to remember everyone needs to get the lock first. And you hold the lock for your entire operation. If you're checking, like for example, if the buffer's not full, you need to hold the lock while doing that, and then while you're taking advantage of the buffer not being full, or something like that. If you ever release the lock, then you have to assume everything's changed about the shared data. This is part of why when we do that condition wait, we have to double check the condition, because it might be the case that someone snuck in there and changed things since we got woken up. But if you ever release the lock for any other reason, you have to assume everything's changed. So you have to check everything again. And for every type of thing you want to wait for, you're gonna create a condition variable. So you're gonna have a list of waiting threads for everything you need to wait for. And you're going to broadcast or signal every time you change those things that are being waited for. You have these loops that do the wait. And we have these kind of like cheats you can do that are slow. Like if you're not sure whether broadcast or signal works, well, broadcast is going to work. If you're not sure if the condition really changed, you can still broadcast or signal. It's still going to work. If you do it a lot, it's probably going to be slow, but if like you only do that rarely, it's not a big deal. And if you can have one condition variable used despite for different things changing, because, well, if you broadcast to that, everyone's going to wake up and check, is the thing I care about now changed or not? So you can kind of delegate the process of checking, did the condition get met to those threads, by just waking them up and having them check, you know, if they're ready to go. So questions? Okay, so let's do exercise here. So I have here a function where we're going to wait for two things to be finished. So we have an array. Of finished booleans that are going to be initially false, and I have something which sets them to true for a particular index, and I want to wait for both of them to be true. So what should my code for that look like? So we'll start with this first while loop condition. What should be in there? Question or no? Or we'll pull afterwards. Okay. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see, who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus for C. So it's while either of them isn't finished yet. So remember, we want to wait while we're not ready to go. It's not. So the most common mistake I see made when people are writing code for this or answering questions about it is flipping this condition, but it's, when do we want to wait? We want to wait if either of them is not finished. Okay, so let's talk about this part. What's the best thing to put? So we'll have two questions here. So which of these is the best option and which of them would work? And assume I spell things correctly. Would like some more time? Okay, so let's start with which of these would work, not which one is best. So who thinks A would be functional, would work? Okay, who thinks A would not work? Some people, no clue? Okay, some mix of that. So we put 3 to the const signal, every time we call finish, we're going to have one of the threads that called wait for both finished wake up and check if both really finished. And this would work fine if there's only one thread ever calling wait for both finished. But if we want to allow multiple threads to do that, it's not going to work. So I would say that this does not work at all. Because in the case where multiple threads are calling wait for both finish, one of them's going to hang, potentially, depending on the timing. Or at least one of them could hang, and we want to prevent that. Okay, how about B? Who thinks B is correct? Not correct? Sort of. Okay. So I would say B is okay, it's not the best solution, but it works. And why does it work? Well, you might say, wait a moment. The first time we call finished, we're going to wake up everyone waiting for both to be finished. Well, that's okay, because we just said they're going to check this condition C, and verify, oh, can we actually go? So we're going to waste some time, so it's not the optimal solution. But when we waste some time, those threads are just going to say, okay, can I actually keep going? Nope, nope, I can't, because only one of them is finished. I need to wait again. So they'll just acquire the lock, check both finished booleans, find out they're not both true, and go back to waiting. So it's going to be okay, but it's not going to work out. How about C? Who thinks C is functional? C is not functional. No clue. So we have mostly not functional, some no clue. So C has the same problem as A has, that if multiple things are waiting, we're going to let one of them stop waiting, even though the condition may have become true. So that's just not going to work in general. How about D? Who thinks D is functional? D is not functional. No clue. So I would say D, I think, is the best sort of these solutions. So we're doing this if statement to check, is the other index of finished also true? We know index is true because we just set it to true. That's the code down there, just sets it to true. So this is kind of a roundabout way of checking here. This we could have also written and gotten the same result if finished 0 and finished 1, which would be more obviously match our condition for the other part. So this is checking the same thing, just in a different way. So it's checking, did that condition become true? And I guess another way we could have written it, which is even more obvious, kind of the same as that, is if not finished 0 or not finished 1, right? We could have also written it this way, but probably wouldn't, to like exactly match the code I use for the while loop. And we're just checking if the while loop is not true anymore after we did this, then we went to broadcast to wake up everyone waiting, no exceptions. We don't want to wake up just one because multiple might have been waiting. Yes? Question, can I go over again, my signal doesn't work? So the problem is that, let's say we call wait for both finish twice, and then we actually do the last finish, then one of the wait for both finish calls is going to get to go because the signal will happen. The other, well, it's still waiting, and it potentially just hangs forever. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So, and I have an alternate exercise here, which I think we'll skip over because I think we were good enough on that and also interested. So there's one other generalization of locks I'd like to talk about, which is semaphores. So this is going to be something which is kind of like combines the functionality of our locks and our condition variables into one thing. And the semaphore is going to have an integer value that it holds, which is a non-negative value, so it's going to be 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. And there's going to be two operations which have different names depending on whose documentation or library you're reading. So there's a P or down or wait operation, which decrements that stored integer. But if it would become negative, instead it waits for it to not become negative, it would have to 1 and then decrements it. And there's an V or up or signal or post operation which increments it, and that's going to wake up someone who's trying to decrement it so they can do it if it would be negative otherwise. And the P and V come from the Dutch because this was originally proposed by Dijkstra's group. Yes, he did more than graph algorithms. And those names have stuck in some libraries. I'm going to use down, wait, and up, and post. I would prefer to use down and up, But unfortunately, the POSIX implementation uses wait and post. So we're going to have to see that in code. So you might say, why is this useful? So it's this integer that we can't read or write directly, and it's negative. So why is this sort of design useful? And one reason why is it has a really nice mapping to kind of our reserving resources idea. So let's think of an analogy. Let's say we have a library where we're reserving books, and I have some sort of pseudo Java syntax here, that if we want to reserve a book, we can think of that as the down operation. We're going to, we have a counter for how many books are free, and if that counter is zero, this down operation isn't going to just return, it's going to wait for the counter not to be zero, so we can decrement it and have it not go negative. The up operation is going to increment the counter, which might let someone calling down go that couldn't go before. So if we think of kind of tracking these copies of our library books, we have three copies, right? We take out one copy, and our semaphore here is three initially, and then we're going to decrement it to two to reserve a copy. And we're tracking how many copies are there. And then if we want to take out another copy or two, we call down again and again, and each time we're decrementing the number of copies we have. So we can think of the semaphore as doing our bookkeeping here for, in this case, how many books do we have free? And a natural consequence of just doing that bookkeeping is that when we ask to reserve a book by decrementing the number of free copies, that operation just waits until a copy is free. So we just do our bookkeeping, and because of the way, the situation under which down will wait for something, we just naturally wait when we need to wait. So that's kind of the attraction of semaphores, is that we can use them where we're just doing bookkeeping, and the bookkeeping causes us to wait when we need to wait and stop waiting when we need to stop waiting. Yes?
So in the reserve book method, would you, for the first comment, would you put like a while loop there and say like while three copies like equals zero or something, so that it forces a wait and checks against the number of copies?
So the question is, if we were doing this with condition variables, would we have a loop in here? So the question, is there a while loop that I haven't written on the slide we'd be doing there in practice? No. The semaphore down operation doesn't require any sort of looping because it's going to handle all of those details for us. So this is why some people really like semaphores, is because they're kind of, for this kind of thing, they're simpler. Right? They just know you're decrementing, we're going to handle waiting for it if we need to, not waiting for it if we don't. And we're going to wait until this down operation kind of internally waits until it's incremented, if needed. Yes?
Yeah, so the down method or operation that you have there would do the waiting. Reserve code would never itself do the waiting.
So the question, the down operation would do the waiting, reserve book would never itself do the waiting? I would say that the down is what we're calling to do the waiting, just like we call conwait to do the waiting with monitors. Other questions? Yeah.
If you treat like the books as like a shared resources, how does it deal with like synchronization? If you try to attempt to modify?
So the question is, how do we deal with synchronization in this model? And we'll talk about that next, but it turns out that we can implement everything we've talked about so far in terms of this semaphore model. We might need more than one semaphore, but we can do it. Yeah. So the question, are the books or copies considered the resources? Yeah, so in this model, our copies are our resources, and we're using the semaphore to track which ones of them are available, how many of them are available.
For the counter three copies, what does that represent in the context of as a thread?
Question, as a thread, so the semaphore stores a value, and this represents the value it stores, and we're manipulating that value by calling the down or up methods of the semaphore operations. Does that answer your question? So we manipulate that value down to zero by calling down. Then if we call down again, down's contract is it doesn't let it go negative, so it's just going to wait until it won't go negative. which means that it's going to kind of pair it up with a call to up. So a call to up will happen, and it's going to let us do the down operation. So the counter will remain at zero, because we're kind of handing off a book from the call to up to the call to down. And kind of each time we call up, if someone's waiting, we'll give them a book. Otherwise, we'll just increment the counter so we track how many people can get a book right away. So this is kind of what semaphores, these counting semaphores do. So we have this count, and maybe it's not so obvious that, oh, I said we can implement all the things we've seen before. So let's start with locks. Let's implement a lock with a semaphore. And here's my implementation. We make a semaphore, we set its initial value to 1, and our lock operation is down. Why does this work? Well, we have one lock that threats can have. We either reserve the lock or return the lock. Kind of like putting on the hat or putting back the hat. That's all we do. Down is reserve it. Now we have 0 locks available for threats. Up is now we have 1. So here's our lock implementation. So as for the question of, oh, can we do the synchronization for the individual copies? Yeah, we can just add an extra semaphore for each copy. Now we have locks. Yeah?
Can semaphores be used for two different processes? Because let's say there's only 1 free copy left, and 2 processes try to call down and have a single copy.
So the question is, what happens if we have 2 calls to down at the same time?
Yeah, and there's only 1.
So in this example, let's say we have another thread that calls down here, right? We have these 2 calls to down. Then when there's 1 call to up, that's going to choose one of these thread down calls to kind of wake up. So each call to up is only going to wake up 1 call to down. So if there's multiple calls to down, they're going to kind of queue up. So we think of, so there's going to be effectively, just like our condition variables, there's going to be a list of waiting threads for each semaphore. Is that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
So if we're using a semaphore, do we need to have a separate queue data structure so that we keep track of who's waiting?
Question, if we're using a semaphore, do we have to have a separate queue data structure to keep track of who's waiting? No. The semaphore somehow keeps track of this internally. So, if we were implementing semaphores with monitors, we'd have, our implementation would have a condition variable in it. Now, semaphores usually are implemented using lower level tools than that, but they'll probably do something very similar to how condition variables would be implemented. Okay, other questions? So that's text. We can also think of thread join. So this is something I showed you how to do with condition variables, where we had a finish flag and we waited for something to be finished. Here, we can just do thread join. And I have the semaphore that's initially 0. And when it's 0, it represents that no thread can go yet. And our join operation is to call down, that we're going to try to decrement it. And if that doesn't work, then we're going to wait until it gets incremented so that can work. And our xset's going to increment it. So we can implement join, we can implement waiting for an event with this pattern. So it turns out that semaphores, because we can do this sort of waiting for event pattern, and we can do mutexes, we can relatively easily, I'm not going to go through all the details, but we can relatively easily show that not only can we use monitors to implement everything semaphores do, but we can use semaphores to implement everything monitors can do. That we can use with some other data structures, yes?
So when we call thread exit and we increment the semaphore, is that to say that the thread didn't terminate gracefully? Whatever, if we thread join, then we would terminate that issue, but are we incrementing the semaphore to say we didn't?
So the question is, why are we incrementing the semaphore here? So my assumption here is that thread exit is called somehow whenever the thread finishes for any reason. So our implementation of join, right, we want to wait for the thread to finish. And what we can think of, we have a counter here. And the counter is, how many times are you allowed to go if you're calling join? And initially, the number of times is 0. And you're reserving a time to go when join is called by calling down. That's what thread join does. And thread exit saying, okay, now one thread that called join can go. So it increments the counter to let that know, them know. And our assumption is that this would be like in the internals of the implementation of pthread create and pthread join could have code like this. Yes?
Yeah, so that, like, would you call exit and then join to say like one thread join and then thread join decrements and then like completes the exit? What's the order?
So the question is, what's the order in which this code would run? So if we have our thread, and we have the thread, it's going to call thread exit, and the code that's calling join, it's going to start join, and it's going to be waiting on the semaphore, right? Assuming it calls it first. And if so, it's going to be woken up by the call to thread exit, and if we have multiple cores, potentially, like, the code like that returns from these functions would be running in parallel. That answer your question?
Yeah, so another thread would call join, then you would like wait on like...
Oh, so the question is, what's the usage of this? Yeah, so by the join function here, I'm thinking of, in our examples of basic pthreads sort of usage, we called pthread create, and then we called pthread join to wait for that thread. This is supposed to be that type of join function. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So POSIX has semaphores. So the way the semaphores work is they're in the semaphore header. There's also some other semaphores you might find. I'm going to teach the ones that I think are the most usable exist in most Unix systems. So the semaphore has a type semt. You create one with seminit, which takes this one parameter, which is 1 if it's process shared and 0 if it's not. So if you make this semt be in the middle of some shared memory, like you get the same way we got memory for the signals lab, then you can actually use a semaphore between multiple processes. There's also ways of doing this with mutexes and condition variables, but it involves the attributes field. And we didn't show it, but it comes up more prominently for seminit. And then you can do a down operation, which POSIX calls wait, and an up operation, which POSIX calls post. So questions on this API? Yeah?
Can you explain process share again?
Can I explain process share? So if it's 0, then the semaphore is not safe to use between threads that come from different processes. If it's 1, then you can do that. So for example, you could make semt be a pointer to something you got by calling mmap on some shared file, like we did in the signals lab. And you could have a semaphore that multiple processes use. So for example, we could do something like the signals lab, but rather than sending signals, we could use semaphore operations to have one of the processes stop waiting.
Why is it unsafe if it's 0?
The implementation of semaphores is allowed to do things that are faster if we assume that like all the global variables are shared and things like that, if it's 0. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise with a semaphore. So here I have a function putValue and getValue, and the idea is that getValue waits for putValue, and putValue and put value waits for get value to happen. So the threads kind of have to meet up at these functions. That's what we want to achieve. So question here is, what do I want to put in these blanks to make this work? So get value needs to wait for a put value to happen. And we also want put value to wait for the get value to finish before it returns. Or put value, sorry, put value not to wait, but we want put value, yeah, we don't want to put value to happen until the last get value has happened, if needed. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B? Okay, C? D? E? And F? No clue. Okay, so we had, I think, consensus for B. So we want to wait until it's do some wait on ready. And why would this make sense? So the intuition I would have is that you want to wait until a put value call happens. So this is going to pair up with the call to send post. That's going to stop someone from waiting. Post stops someone from waiting. So we want to pair up with that. And we want to do that before we get a value. So that's what needs to be first, because we better not get a value until put value is done. And then we have something where put value needs to wait for us to be done before we do the next put value. So I'm going to have a send post that matches up with that send wait there. Post to end. Some questions how I figured that out? Yeah. Question, is this an example of a producer consumer? Yes, so this is an example with only one space. So we can generalize that by saying, okay, so a way we can think about this is that our empty semaphore, this is counting the number of empty slots, and our ready semaphore is counting the number of filled slots. And we're kind of controlling, counting the number we have. We're just doing the bookkeeping on that number. That when we put a value, we take an empty slot away, and we add a ready slot. When we're getting a value, we take a ready slot away, and we add an empty slot. So we're just doing the bookkeeping and tracking those two numbers. And it's kind of the general way I think of semaphores is think of a thing we can do bookkeeping for that's going to be zero when we need to wait. So the number of empty slots, the number of full slots, the number of threads that can go, and so on. And once you've thought of that counter, just use up and down whenever the count should change. And you'll just naturally wait when you're supposed to wait. And we can apply this to kind of a more general producer-consumer. So we can think of our constraints for producer-consumer. We want to wait if the buffer is empty, we want to wait if the buffer is full, and we want to have the buffer only manipulated by one thread at a time. So we can do that by having a semaphore for each constraint. And we'll have a semaphore that counts the number of slots that have stuff in them. That's what we're going to decrement when we consume an item. We're going to have a semaphore that counts the number of slots that are available for producers to use. That's what we're going to decrement when we produce an item. And we'll have a semaphore that implements a mutex, so it's going to be 0 or 1. 0 if someone's using the buffer right now, 1 if not. So it represents the number of threads that can use the buffer right now. And so our code would look like this. We take our semaphores. We say initially we have zero full slots. So semi-init takes the number that the semaphore initially has. Initially we have the butt capacity empty slots. And then we wait for a full slot. Then we lock the buffer, enqueue something, unlock the buffer. And then we tell any consumer, hey, now there's an additional full slot. We increment the number of full slots. And in consume, we're doing the opposite. We wait for a full slot. Once we have one, we lock the buffer. We dequeue something. And then we mark that now there's an additional slot empty, so an additional consumer can go, or producer can go. So questions about this example here? Yeah?
Can you go back to the multiple
choice? To the what?
To the multiple choice. What do you want buffer? Yeah. Where is the buffer in that producer consumer?
In this example here?
Yeah.
Where's the buffer? So our buffer in this example, so this is producer consumer, but our buffer is this one value. So it's a buffer that can hold one thing. So in this case, our semaphores will be either 0 or 1, because there's at most one empty slot, at most one full slot. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? And so sort of what we're doing is we're just tracking the number of empty and full slots. That's our main producer-consumer logic. And you can see from this why some people really like semaphores. Personally, I taught monitors first because I think for the most part they're easier to use just because there's a lot of problems which don't fit so naturally into semaphores. You can absolutely do everything with semaphores, but sometimes it requires some different patterns, that I'm probably not going to teach, but there are ways of doing everything that we've done with condition variables with semaphores. Kind of the general approach when you get stuck is that you can do something where you let one thread go at a time and have a counter of how many threads need to go that you predict with a mutex, basically. Okay, so in our last few minutes, I'm going to talk about one other topic we're just going to discuss briefly. We're not going to implement, but something we need to want you to be aware of is there's some higher level ideas for synchronization. And one idea which comes up a lot is an idea called a transaction. So far when we've been worrying about synchronization, we've been saying, okay, we have to coordinate, that when different threads run exactly to prevent conflicts. And that's kind of an inconvenient model for coding things that manipulate shared data. So another model that seems really convenient is this idea of a transaction, that we're just going to specify, here's a set of operations, and they're all going to happen all at once, meaning they're going to be atomic. And when we remember we said atomic means that they all happen or they don't happen. We don't have any in between. We don't have any partially done things. So if we think of our all the cases we need locking, this would kind of solve that. We just don't need to worry about which locks do we acquire, how do we make sure everyone's acquiring the same locks. We just do a transaction, and if the transaction happens all at once, that's great. Now, of course, implementing this, it's a little tricky. But there are systems which provide this kind of transaction interface. The most common you'll see is many databases provide this. So for many databases, you can say, here's a bunch of updates I want to make to the database. Do it as a transaction. And the database is going to handle doing all the locking and all that stuff you need to make sure that it's as if it did that whole transaction and nothing else happened in the middle. That might not really be the case, but it's going to simulate that with the appropriate locking. So if we write the equivalent of this for a database will handle, handle making sure that nothing else changes the balance in between, because this is going to happen as if it's one single atomic operation that nothing else interferes with. And actually, when we speak about transaction, there's kind of two notions of this happens all at once that you'll see commonly implemented. So one is that no other operations interfere, and that's called consistency, that if we're running multiple transactions together, we'll have consistent results in that it will look like, you know, we did one, then the other, we didn't do some mix of two operations. So we're thinking about this bank account example, we didn't, you know, we don't have a lost write. We don't have two updates that were only one of them happen. One of them overwrote the other without handling that amount of money. Another common approach, a common thing that people talk about with transactions happening all at once is related to what I'll call durability. This is, if we have a crash, what operations have been done? So with a database, if you're doing this operation, you probably want it to be the case that if the database is doing this operation and we have a crash right here before we do the last set balance, you'd like it to be the case that either nothing happened and we'll just redo the whole thing, or that all of it happened. You don't want some in-between result if your database machine crashes and comes back up. And so this notion is commonly called durability, and many systems that provide transactions are also, or at least are trying to provide that functionality too, that it happens all at once in the sense that if there's a crash, you're not going to see an in-between state. You're going to see the whole thing's done or the whole thing's not done. So questions about these sort of two separate goals that we often have for transactions, this consistency versus this durability. Okay, so how can, we'll talk about how to implement the consistency part, unless, I don't think we'll have time to talk about how you implement durability. So for consistency, there's one way which is really simple and works. Just run one at a time. Just have a big lock, and don't do anything without acquiring that lock. And for a transaction, you acquire the lock, you do all the operations, then you unlock. And this works, but if your database is implementing transactions and meant to be fast, you probably aren't very happy. So another kind of way of doing it is we can do locking. So for every time we do a read operation, we acquire the appropriate lock first, and we only unlock when the whole transaction is done. But then you say, hey, couldn't we have deadlock here? So yes, but because of the structure of this transaction, we have a solution for deadlock. What we can do is we can have this set balance operation. Instead of actually modifying the balance, this is going to, you know, write down the change, you know, the change for later. And this end transaction operation is going to apply pending changes. So we'll separate it out. So we won't actually modify things for real until the end transaction. And then, given that, if we have a deadlock, what we can do is abort the transaction, stop it, and just start it later from begin transaction. We just jump back to begin transaction and do it again. And because we've only written down the writes that we're going to make, we haven't actually made them for real, that can be fine. And this is a strategy that some databases implement. This is one way of handling this operation. So we have, on a deadlock, we have a way of undoing it. An easy way is that we haven't actually made the changes yet. We've just recorded the changes we're going to make. And that means that we, if there's a deadlock, we can handle it without, you know, having anything get corrupted. Another approach, that's another kind of database approach, is we can kind of, when we read from the things, we can copy the values we read, and on write, we record the value we're going to write, but don't write it yet. And at the end of the transaction, we don't do any locking in the middle here to like hold locks for a while. Instead, at the end of the transaction, we just check, hey, are all the things that we read still there? Then we lock and check, did all the reads I do make sense? And because we're doing all this locking just at the end, we don't have to worry about deadlock because we can do those locks in a good order. And if things change, we just go back to the beginning and try again. Okay, so questions on our transaction strategies? Yes? Question, this seems to do twice as much operations? Yes, so we're doing extra work, yeah, because we're recording a value and then actually really changing it again, yes. So yeah, we're writing the value one place and then writing it to the real place, yeah. So we're kind of doing, in some sense, twice as much work, yes. Does that answer your question? I guess I would say, hopefully, when we're recording the values to be written, that's not too much work to do. But yeah, it is a concern. That's where I'll finish up.